From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We're back at home now, and the president and his cabinet are moving full steam ahead on the president's agenda.
That was White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer Tuesday, returning to his daily press briefings after returning from President Trump's first trip abroad.
As the president noted this weekend, his plan for the most significant tax reform in decades continues to progress, led by Secretary Mnuchin and NEC Director Cohn. While the president was away, the team here held several meetings with members in leadership. In particular, Secretary Mnuchin met separately with the House Ways and Means Committee, Republican and Democrat members, the Freedom Caucus, and the Republican Study Committee.
His appearance at the microphone Tuesday apparently put to rest rumors last week that he was leaving his job.
We'll begin holding industry listening sessions next week, providing an opportunity for business leaders and job creators to give us their inputs on what reforms are necessary to allow us to grow jobs and the economy. This morning, the president met with Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Pruitt. One of the topics that they discussed, of course, was the president's upcoming decision on the Paris Climate Accords. As I've told you overseas, this is the subject that the president is spending a great deal of time on, and one that he spoke to the G7 members about during their meetings. Ultimately, he wants a fair deal for the American people, and he will have an announcement coming on that shortly.
After Spicer had reported on Trump's recent activities, he took questions from reporters.
To the issue of the Russia probe, I'm wondering, Sean, if you can tell us when the president knew, whether the president knew at the time that Jared Kushner was seeking to establish back-channel communications at the Russian embassy to the Russian government. And if he didn't know at the time, when did he find out?
I think that assumes a lot, and I would just say that Mr. Kushner's attorney has said that Mr. Kushner has volunteered to share with Congress what he knows about these meetings, and he will do the same if he's contacted and connected with any other inquiry.
Did the president discuss it, though?
I'm not going to get into what the president did or did not discuss, but what your question assumes is a lot of facts that are not substantiated by anything but anonymous sources that are so far being leaked out.
Does he approve of that action?
You're asking if he approves of an action that is not a confirmed action. That being said, I think Secretary Kelly and General McMaster have both discussed that in general terms, back channels are an appropriate part of diplomacy.
So does the White House dispute that happened?
I'm not going to get into it, but your question presupposes facts that have not been confirmed. Francesca.
Thank you, Sean. That the president retweeted this morning an article about that back channel that was based on an anonymous source that said that there was an effort to set up a back channel, that it was the Russians who suggested that, and that it was to talk about Syria. Was the president not confirming that effort, that there was an effort, and the facts that I just said?
I think what I just said speaks for itself.
But you said that first of all, that the article was based on anonymous sources.
Which it is.
But the Fox article that the president retweeted was also based on anonymous sources. Why are those sources, or the source rather, that they used more credible than the ones in the Washington Post article?
Again, I don't think there's two issues at hand. One is the statement that Jared's attorney has provided. Second is whether or not the dossier that is largely the basis of this was largely discredited in the first place. Most of the publications here refused to even publish it in the first place. So again, I'm not going to get into confirming stuff. There's an ongoing investigation. John. Gizzy.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Sean. I have two questions. First, the president, for the second time in a month, retweeted his desire for the Senate to reduce the votes to pass anything to 51, which would effectively scuttle the filibuster for legislation as it has been scuttled for nominations. Is this something he discussed with Majority Leader McConnell or any of the Senate leadership before he tweeted it?
I think the concerns that he's had with the pace of the Senate has been longstanding. Obviously, the use of the filibuster and the rules of the Senate are ultimately up to Senator McConnell. But I think that the frustration that he's had with the pace of some of the legislation and some of the obstructionist tactics that Democrats have employed, whether it's his cabinet nominees or other pieces of legislation, has been well documented.
But he wants to scrap the filibuster entirely, is right.
I think he wants to see action done, John. That's what the president wants. Whether it's the delays that Democrats pose to his cabinet nominees or pieces of legislation, he wants action. This president was elected to get things done, and he's he wants to see things move through the House and the Senate, especially when you've got a majority of support and people to stop playing games. Zeke?
Second question, I did want to mention that before he left to go abroad, the president praised Philippine President Duterte for his action against drug dealers and dealing with them. Various human rights groups have condemned President Duterte, saying that a lot of the executions of drug dealers have been done without trial. Does the president stand by his words of praise for the Philippine president?
I think the president recognizes the need to combat drugs, but he also believes in human rights. It's something that he's worked with several countries. It's one of the reasons that he's reviewing the Cuba policy, et cetera. He wants human rights. It's something that's very strong to him. It's something that he's discussed in private with several countries. Zeke?
Tomorrow's the deadline for the interest in MCI, the expiration of the last Obama waiver, the six-month waiver. Has the president made a decision whether or not to sign another waiver?
No.
So that decision will be made in the next 24 hours, presumably?
When the president has a decision to make, we'll let you know.
And secondly, we're also waiting on a few other reviews, both for the ISIS review as well as the Afghanistan review.
Right.
What is the status of those? You mentioned that Paris will be hearing this week. The president said, what about the other two subjects?
I think on the Afghanistan review, he's still reviewing that from the Department of Defense. When we have an announcement, we'll let you know. Sarah?
John, the president tweeted on Sunday that he thinks Republicans should, quote, add more dollars to health care and make it the best anywhere. What did he mean by that?
Well, there's a lot of savings that are coming out of the repeal and replace effort right now. I think we're at $119 billion that we saved through the president's efforts. And I think the health care has been something that the president's been very clear on throughout his time as a candidate, well through his presidency, to make sure that the American people get the care and the accessibility that they need. He understands how important health care is, and the bottom line is he's going to do whatever it takes to make sure that people have quality, accessible health care.
Add more dollars, did he mean to the high-risk pools? Did he mean to the cost-sharing reduction payments? Where did he want to add
I think this is the bill's in progress. Obviously, it's in the Senate right now, and he's willing to work with them to do what it takes. Olivier.
Thanks, John. Following on one of Zeke's questions, Afghanistan's now the country's longest war. How much more American blood and treasure is the president willing to expend, and does he think it's a winnable conflict?
I think the conflict that he wants to defeat ISIS. He wants to defeat Al-Qaeda. He wants to defeat threats to defeat terrorism. I think I just read to you throughout the trip, that was the common thread, the uniting the Muslim world, talking about it with Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Abbas, talking about it even with the Pope, that wherever he went on this 9-day trip, protecting our country, protecting the world's people, was at the front of that discussion. And I think he wants to do whatever he has to do to make sure that our country is safe and our people are safe. That's why he's asked for this review.
Right. Sean, let me ask you a couple if you don't mind. First on tax reform, the president tweeted over the weekend that it was going, quote, very well. You just used the word progress. However, Republicans on the Hill still appear to be divided. The president tweeted today that maybe they should reverse the filibuster rule. So I'm wondering what the progress is and what is it that is going very well at this point in time.
I think the reception that Secretary Mnuchin and others on the staff have gotten from leadership, members of the House Ways and Means Committee, Senate Finance, et cetera, has been very welcoming, as well as in the business community. But I think obviously part of the as I just mentioned to the previous question, part of the reason that he is frustrated with the Senate rules is because when there is a majority of support on key issues or key people, as the case was in the confirmation progress, he thinks it's standing in the way of progress that the American people have asked for.
Let me ask you about the FBI director. Before the foreign trip, Joe Lieberman was the leading candidate identified by the president. Mr. Lieberman's out. Where does the FBI director search stand? John Pistol, is he at the White House interviewing today? Is he the leading candidate at this point?
The president will be meeting with two additional candidates this afternoon, both Chris Wray and John Pistol. When the president feels as though he's met with the right candidate, he'll let us know. But he'll meet with candidates today and continue to do so until he finds the right leader.
Are they the two finalists of an expanding group?
The president is the ultimate decision maker, and when he makes a decision as to who he believes is best to lead the FBI, he will let us know. Katie.
Sean. The president tweeted that tax reform is going well, but you just said that he's actually very frustrated with the lack of progress in the Senate. So does the White House still stand by its August deadline for tax reform? And does the White House still believe that health care, tax reform, and infrastructure is going to get done this year?
So just so we're clear, there's two separate issues, right? One is, I think the talks that Secretary Mnuchin and other members of the staff have had and the reception that they've gotten to the president's bold tax reform proposal is extremely welcoming. I think the president in general finds it frustrating the way how the Senate operates. And again, I'm dating this back to the holdup that they had on some of these unbelievably well-qualified nominees. So they're not... We don't want to mix those two issues together. But I think he feels very, very encouraged by the reception that he's gotten to tax reform. Secretary Mnuchin, who had made the comment about August, had talked about, while that was a goal, that we'll continue to work as hard as we can to get it done. But we've got a pretty bold agenda. He's still pushing hard on health care. Infrastructure is a priority of his. So the president's legislative agenda is in full swing. Yeah. No.
Where do you see the state of the U.S.-German relationship right now, and how important is that relationship to the White House and the president and the American public?
I think the relationship that the president has had with Merkel, he would describe as fairly unbelievable. They get along very well. He has a lot of respect for her. They continue to grow the bond that they had during their talks in the G7. And he views not just Germany but the rest of Europe as an important American ally. During his conversations at NATO and at the G7, the president reaffirmed the need to deepen and improve our transatlantic relationship.
And how did he view her comments that she felt that Europe could no longer depend on the United States?
Well, respectfully, that's not what she said. So since you're misquoting the chancellor, let me read what she actually said. She said, "The time when Europe could rely solely on others is somewhat in the past. And as I've witnessed over the past few days, Europe must take its fate into its own hands. This means working in friendship with the U.S., the U.K., and neighborly relations with Russia and other partners." That's great. That's what the president called for. He called for additional burden sharing. The Secretary General of NATO said that the president's calls are what's moving them in the right direction. The president is getting results, and more countries are stepping up their burden sharing. That is a good thing for them, it's a good thing for NATO, and it's a good thing for America. Scott Thuman.
Yeah, Sean, has the president been meeting with lawyers specifically about defending himself in the special counsel investigation into Russia? I'm sure you've probably seen the reports that Congressman Adams likes Jared Kushner before his committee, and possibly even go over his clearances.
I'm not going to dignify partisan accusations of anonymous sources and alleged unsubstantiated attacks. I'm not even going to just
about the president whether or not he's had any meetings.
The president has a lot of meetings. If the president has a decision on anything, we'll be sure to let you know.
Sean,
yeah, Brian.
First, welcome back, by the way. Thanks. Two quick questions. This weekend, while you all were gone, someone shot up the Lexington Herald Leader, and of course, we understand what happened in Montana with now Congressman Gianforte. I think he has a misdemeanor charge of assault. Will this administration take a stand against violence aimed at reporters?
We'll take a stance against violence against any individual.
Well, and so would you, all right, second, let me follow that up with, would you support legislation? You all have been the ones that have come out screaming against fake media. Would you support legislation that would support real reporting, such as this Shield Law I've asked you before, such as other?
We have a constitution, Brian, that supports the First Amendment, which allows all Americans, and anyone in this country, frankly, the freedom of expression. We support that full.
The second question. When you say that you're going to try to defeat ISIS and Al-Qaeda, what are you doing to eliminate the abject poverty that is the breeding ground for the terrorists?
As we've mentioned before, his national security team is putting together a holistic solution to defeating ISIS. When that strategy is complete, we'll have something for you on it.
So you said that a back channel is an appropriate part of diplomacy.
I didn't say that. I said that Secretary Kelly and General McMaster have both commented on that.
Can you add more to that? Well, how is it that it's appropriate for someone who is a private citizen, not sworn in as an official of the U.S. government, to conduct any kind of negotiation or diplomacy with a foreign official?
Again, I would just refer you to both the comments that Secretary Kelly, General McMaster have said about how they can be an important tool in diplomacy.
But at the time, there was no one who was close to the president who was working in an official government capacity. How is that appropriate?
Again, I think that both of those individuals who are steeped in national security and foreign policy have said that that can be an effective tool, generally speaking, in diplomacy. Shannon.
I know the president hasn't made a public decision on the Paris agreement, and I know you don't want to get out ahead of him, but on the more broad issue of climate change, can you say whether or not the president believes that human activity is contributing to the warming of the climate?
Honestly, I haven't asked him.
Okay.
And get back to you.
And do you feel like that is a decision he's still trying to make?
I don't know. I honestly haven't asked him that specific question, so I would feel.
And then just real quick on healthcare to follow up on a question back there. So as part of the tweet about wanting to add more money to get better healthcare, would the president consider, putting back some of the Obamacare taxes that were taken out of the health bill as it goes into the Senate? Would he be in support of keeping taxes in there to help pay for healthcare?
Again, that negotiation is ongoing with the Senate, and I don't want to presuppose what the president may or may not want to do. Deborah.
Let me finish, please. Thank you, Sean, for calling on me. Angela Merkel's quote, "We Europeans must really take our destiny into our own hands." How did the president react to that? And will this have any effect on what he wants to do, what he decides to do with Paris?
No, I think he, like I said a moment ago, the president believes that seeing Europe and other NATO countries increase their burden sharing is a very positive thing for their own countries, for NATO as a whole, and for the United States. To see these individuals heed the call that he has so eloquently put out over the last several, well over a year. But when you look at the comments that the Secretary General made, he recognizes that the president's rhetoric has had an extremely positive effect on the strengthening of NATO and other countries stepping up the percent of their own GDP that they're putting towards their common national defense. That benefits everybody. It benefits us, it benefits NATO, and it benefits themselves.
And will it affect his decision on Paris?
What, I'm sorry?
Will it have any effect on his decision
on Paris? Obviously, that's what he ultimately decides is up to him.
Sean, does the departure of Michael Dubkey signal some kind of broader reorganization in the West Wing? Obviously, we're hearing that campaigning, so Gordon Dubkey and David Bossie might be returning. There's a war room setting up to deal with production reservations.
I don't think so. I think the president is very pleased with his team, and he has a robust agenda, as I've just outlined, that he looks forward to working with Congress to get done to achieve results for the American people.
Is the White House considering changing how you communicate the president's message at all? I mean, be it him communicating directly more or different faces at the podium?
Well, I don't think that there's anything that we haven't said before about how, the president has a unbelievably qualified cabinet, and we've utilized them a ton in the past. If we can continue to do that on key issues, we're going to do that. Ultimately, the best messenger is the president himself. He's always proven that he is the best messenger, not just for what he wants to articulate, but that the American people resoundingly chose him as their president because he understands the frustrations and concerns and values of the American people, and he is probably the best person to communicate that.
Do you think that he is happy with the messaging that's been done thus far?
I think he's very pleased with the work of his staff. I think that he is frustrated, like I am and like so many others, to see stories come out that are patently false, to see narratives that are wrong, to see quote-unquote fake news. When you see stories get perpetrated that are absolutely false, that are not based in fact, that is troubling. And he's rightly concerned.
Can you give an example of fake news, Sean?
I'll give you an example.
Please.
Sure. Friday, the president was having a great discussion at the G7. And someone from the BBC and ultimately an incoming reporter from the New York Times retweeted that the president was being rude by disrespecting the Italian prime minister. And when in fact, you all, in every one of the meetings that we sit in, watch the president with that one earpiece that's been used by other presidents. And yet, the president did a great job at NATO, building stronger bonds at the G7, increasing America's presence around the world. And that's the kind of thing that the BBC and ultimately the reporter who's now joining the New York Times push out and perpetuate with no apology. What, you're shaking your head, Peter. I mean, it's true. You did it. No, and I'm answering James, but I think...
reporters make mistakes.
No, but that's not... But that's just fake.
Your trip was all over the front page. You're making something out of one tweet instead of the
mistakes like that. With all due respect, I was asked to give an example, and I did it.
You did it prominence than anybody ever.
I gave an answer to Jim. The problem is that I think the president, to the question, gets frustrated when he sees fake stories get published, things that aren't based in fact, and a narrative gets pushed.
Significant though. That's just so.
Well, with all due respect, I think when you see instances like that get perpetrated over and over again, that is frustrating. I'm not here. I didn't come here with a list of things, but I think that there's well. Thank you. I appreciate it. What you get to decide what's big and what's not. I think this. There's a lot of the stuff that has gotten pushed out based on unnamed, unaccountable sources that is very troubling. And I think when you see the same kind of thing happen over and over again, it is concerning. And I think the president has fought very hard to bring back jobs. You, as I mentioned, you had over $500 billion of investment that's coming in that's going to grow jobs, grow our economy. That should be a big story. The president's results when it came to fighting terrorism was a big thing. The idea that we're standing up a global center to fight extremism in Saudi Arabia that's uniting Muslim countries, that's a big deal.
I think that reports that there's going to be an overhaul of the communications operation or fake news.
That's the question. I know. So now you want to come back to that. What I'm telling you is that the reason that the president is frustrated is because there's a perpetuation of false narratives, a use of unnamed sources over and over again about things that are happening that don't ultimately happen, and I think that is troubling. Thank you guys very much.
The president's visit in particular to Saudi Arabia and his claims that Tehran is a primary sponsor of terrorism puzzled many analysts, including some at the State Department who were asked to defend it.
You were over there. The secretary criticized the conduct of the Iranian elections and Iran's record on democracy. He did so standing next to Saudi officials. How do you characterize Saudi Arabia's commitment to democracy? And does the administration believe that democracy is a buffer or barrier or against extremism?
This was Acting Assistant Secretary of State Stuart Jones, who accompanied the president to Saudi Arabia last week, briefing reporters on the trip's achievements.
I think what we'd say is that at this meeting, we were able to make significant progress with Saudi and GCC partners in both making a strong statement against extremism and also putting in place certain measures through this GCC mechanism where we can combat extremism. Clearly, one source of extremism, terrorism threat is coming from Iran. And that's coming from a part of the Iranian apparatus that is not at all responsive to its electorate.
Press TV's Marzia Hashemi has more.
During the visit to Saudi Arabia, Trump signed a $110 billion arms deal with the kingdom. Trump unleashed a barrage of criticism against Iran while he totally remained silent on the issue of human rights in Saudi Arabia and its deadly war on Yemen. The U.S. president's anti-Iran posture coincided with the presidential election in Iran, where huge voter turnout dominated the headlines in mainstream media. Let's cross over to Washington, D.C., joined by former U.S. Senate foreign policy analyst, Mr. James Jontras. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, it seems that even for the State Department, it's getting more and more difficult to try to defend White House policies in dealing with Saudi Arabia. Your take on what is going on? Of course, it's not really anything different, we can say, that President Trump is doing than Obama and then previous presidents, but it seems that at least the jargon and everything is a little bit different. How do you see all of this?
Well, to start with, as a former State Department official myself, I was really astounded by Mr. Jones's performance. He's, I'm sure, a very smart man, a very experienced diplomat, but you could almost hear the wheels turning in his head as he searched for something he could say that wouldn't sound completely ridiculous. And of course, he didn't really succeed in his response because he knows very well that there's no democracy in Saudi Arabia, whereas in Iran, they have elections. His answer that there's part of the Iranian government apparatus that's not responsible to the electorate is almost a left-handed compliment to suggest that, well, I guess there are other parts of the apparatus that are responsible to the electorate, unlike in Saudi Arabia.
So what does this say, though, in general about the United States? On the one hand, obviously, it seems from this official and others and that they realize, really, there is no defense for Saudi Arabia, and yet ties are very close. We saw Trump in the region last week and signing these deals. What's going on? What does it all mean?
You know, to tell the truth, I'm not sure. There are some people who think that it is exactly what you see. It is that we are in with both feet. We are fully supporting what is seen by people here in Washington as a Sunni versus Shiite war within Islam. We are firmly taking the Sunni side. Somehow, in somebody's mind, that relates with moderation, although there's nothing moderate, certainly, about the Wahhabist establishment in Saudi Arabia. Other people think that there's something more clever going on here, that we know very well that the Saudis cannot even use most of those weapons. Many of them go to warehouses because they don't have the capability to use them, that it's a lot of money coming in, and of course everybody likes to sell his weapons, and that he's basically giving them enough rope to hang themselves. I really don't know, to tell the truth. I suspect it probably isn't all that complicated, that there are people in his administration who have certain geopolitical concepts of the world that are no different from Obama's, no different from George W. Bush's, and that Trump, for whatever reason, is going on along with that now. And of course, it makes no sense and certainly does not relate to the national interest of the United States.
And we close with this commentary from BlackAgendaReport.com senior editor Glenn Ford.
If all you know is what you read in the newspapers and see and hear on the rest of the corporate media, then you've been given the impression that in less than 100 days, Barack Obama was dethroned as the champion deporter of unwanted immigrants in the history of the United States. Donald Trump, for his own race-baiting reasons, would also like you to believe the misleading headlines. But it's not true, and the actual numbers tell us that Obama will likely remain the all-time deporter-in-chief. Although arrests of immigrants during the first 90 days of this year increased significantly over the same period of 2016, Obama's last year in office, they still amounted to only one-third or less of the immigrant arrests during the peak Obama years of 2011 and 2012. Just as the New York Times methodically distorts and objectively falsifies its coverage of Syria and foreign affairs in general in order to stoke the fires of war, the paper last Saturday deliberately constructed a misleading picture of Trump's record of deportations during his first 3 months in office. At the top of the story, in the first paragraph, the Times tells us that immigration and customs agents arrested a little more than 41,000 people between January 22nd and April 29th, compared to about 30,000 during the same period in 2016. That's a jump from about 10,000 arrests per month in Obama's last year to almost 14,000 monthly detentions during Trump's first year. But you have to read three-quarters of the article to learn that Barack Obama was arresting more than twice as many immigrants as Trump, 29,000 a month, back in 2011. And you'd have to do your own research to learn that Obama arrested and deported even more people than that in his peak year, 2012. At the rate that Donald Trump is going, he'll have to become far more aggressive if he ever wants to come even close to Obama's immigrant arrest and removal record. Obama's rate of removal of unwanted immigrants was in the stratosphere for 6 of his 8 years in office, before he started thinking about cleaning up his historical legacy as a phony progressive and a friend of immigrants. The New York Times gets away with its blatant distortion of facts in this case because Donald Trump wants folks to believe that he is the worst thing ever to happen to undocumented people. Trump's operatives at Homeland Security bragged that the statistics reflect President Trump's commitment to enforce our immigration laws fairly and across the board. But actually, the statistics show that Barack Obama is damn near unbeatable when it comes to kicking people out of the country, and Trump is not yet even a contender. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.